You are listening to Antiloop podcast with me, Anna Svan, and my colleague, Martin Sandqvist. In this week's episode, we are interviewing Ronnie Stöfferle, one of the authors of the Ingold We Trust report. So without further ado, here's the interview.
We saw those regional U.S. banks failing. I thought it was pretty interesting that that Bitcoin was up, I think, on one of those days, like 10%. So it might kind of change from being a risk-on asset to becoming a risk-off asset. Yeah. If it will be still around, then I would say that the price should be significantly higher. Will gold be around in 10 years and will it protect your purchasing power? I think yes, it will continue to do its job due to the Lindy effect. It's prudent to own both, obviously volatility adjusted.
We are very thrilled to have Ronnie Stöfferle joining us today, renowned for his expertise in global macroeconomics and precious metals, especially gold. As you are one of the authors of the Ingold We Trust report, we couldn't have asked for a better guest today. So welcome to the show, Ronnie. But before we go into the report, could you share a little bit about your background and how you began writing Ingold We Trust, and perhaps also shed some light on this year's title, Showdown?
Good morning, Anna. Thanks for hosting me. Tusen Tag, I think, is...
Yes.
My Swedish is very limited, but thank you very much for having me. Well, where should I start? I mean, I got interested into the topic of gold when I was still at Erste Group, a Vienna-based bank, and I was responsible for, in the research department, I was responsible for Asian equities. But I bought my first stocks when I was like, I think 14 or 15. And I was always fascinated by stock markets. So besides researching equities, I was always investing and I always wanted to move into the investment side later on. So I privately held one gold mining stock that did tremendously well. Actually, it was, I think, one out of 1,000 junior explorers that actually made it to production. So I was pretty lucky, and I would say, you know, having a 40 bagger as your first gold mining investment, that's a blessing but also a curse, because I thought, well, that's pretty easy. So I owned this junior mining explorer and got interested into the topic of gold. So I went to my boss and said, well, you know, could I write like a little special report on gold? I'm really fascinated by this topic. And he said, yeah, go ahead. Gold is always interesting. And little did I know that, you know, now 17 editions later, the Ingold We Trust report is the most widely followed publication on gold worldwide. We publish in German, in English, in Mandarin, and now also in Spanish. And the topic of gold really, you know, it continues to amaze me, to fascinate me, because actually it's not about gold itself. It's about everything else. It's about, you know, interest rates. It's about inflation. It's about geopolitics. It's about politics. It's about opportunity costs. So you never get bored writing about gold. And you know, I think that going forward, you know, we will still continue improving the product. The Ingold We Trust report now is a publication that has many other publications, like our monthly Gold Compass, for example. But in general, I have to say, because most people think I'm only the author of the Ingold We Trust report, primarily we're in the business of managing assets. So I'm managing partner at a fund management company based in Liechtenstein, Incrementum AG. So writing the Ingold We Trust report is just one part part of my job at the moment.
Well, yeah. I must say that we were happy that you had that 40 bagger, because the Ingoldi Trust Report is definitely mandatory reading at this office.
It's like Christmas time every time it comes out.
It's the time of the year we usually say.
I recommend everybody to read the whole report as it comes out. It's about 400 or 500 pages on incrementum.com, and you can just download it for free. So that's
everyone that's listening that still hasn't, you need to. But could you tell us a little bit more about the title this year, Showdown? What does it mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, the we always try to find a leitmotif, a title that really sums up what's going on in the whole world, which is not easy. And last year, for example, we had Stagflation 2.0, which I think played out really well. And this year we chose Showdown. And actually we see a showdown, you know, this picture of a showdown, for example, when you play poker, or from a Western movie. We see actually three different showdowns. So the first showdown is basically when it comes to monetary policy. We have seen the most aggressive rate hike cycle of the last basically 40 years. So at the moment, we're seeing a showdown between the Federal Reserve and central banks in general that try to reestablish confidence. So central banks versus market participants. Central bankers try to not cause a recession, so they want to orchestrate some sort of a soft landing. But then on the other hand, from our point of view, we all got so accustomed to low rates, to huge amounts of liquidity. We all got so used to this Fed put, basically, like Pavlovian dogs that are trained to this kind of reaction by central bankers. So we're seeing kind of a trilemma: monetary policy trying to fight inflation versus not causing a recession. And from our point of view, we probably are already on the verge of a recession. And then on the third hand, financial market stability. And I think that if you have a look at the troubles that we're seeing in the regional banking system in the United States, well, everybody would say, well, it's primarily, you know, bad management and so on. But those things happening in the regional banking space, but also in the crypto space, for example, those troubles that are arising in the real estate, especially in the commercial real estate space, those are all signs that actually we cannot afford rates at these levels anymore. So we are trapped in this, what we called in our last book, the zero rate trap. We all got accustomed to that. And I think now we're seeing the consequences. So therefore, our call is pretty clear. A recession is definitely our base case.
But then how do you see this showdown playing out with respect to the Fed? And I mean, how they, I mean, I guess at some point they're going to have to make a choice between the system and inflation. So how do you see that end game sort of playing out?
Well, I would say, you know, if we have a look at real rates, for example, and if you calculate real rates with inflation expectations, like 1 year down the road, actually we have seen a huge move. And I think to be fair, I wouldn't have expected such a big move on the rate side. And I talked to many strategists, analysts, fund managers from all over the world. And I don't know any analyst, any strategist, any investor that has really forecasted such a big hawkish move from, first of all, from the Federal Reserve, and then also continued by most other central banks. So this has definitely been a big surprise for markets. But from my point of view, we are probably in the final stage of this hiking cycle, because a recession is is coming up pretty quickly. And you know, there are so many signs for that. We're seeing the yield curve being inverted. We're seeing that earnings are coming in weaker. We're seeing that the equity markets they try to see the most positive outcome as always, which would be a soft landing. But I think, you know, market participants are, or especially economists, they often underestimate the time lags that are involved. And we compare that to we call it the tequila theory of money. It's like with pouring tequila shots. Yeah. At the first, you know, 1, 2, 3, everything is fine. You're having a good time. But then, you know, with some sort of a time lag, you see the effects kicking in. And the day after feels horrible, especially the older you get. So I think that most people are underestimating the time lags involved of this extremely hawkish rate hike cycle that we have seen. And therefore, I would say that the three stages of the pivot that everybody is waiting for, I think there are three distinct stages, which is, first of all, lowering rate hikes. We got used to 75 basis points. I mean, that's pretty quite a lot. Then we already did that. Yeah, we're now at 25 basis points. The second one is the pause. And I think that over the summer, we will probably see the Federal Reserve pausing their rate hike campaign. And then the third stage only is when they start panicking and start lowering rates again. And this could happen, I don't know, in September, probably. But I think this is going to happen. And this will probably be the time when gold really takes off. So I think the fact that the price of gold is holding up so well, despite the fact that real rates have risen that dramatically, that the 10 years, for example, are trading at 3.8%. So this is a really big opportunity costs for holding gold. So I think that's a pretty strong sign. And I think this showdown in monetary policy, it's going to happen pretty soon. I think the emperor has no clothes. And therefore, I do not see, especially in where US elections are coming up next year, I just don't see that the Federal Reserve will continue on this hawkish with this hawkish narrative if a recession arises. And as I've said, due to our models, due to our indicators that we follow and that we described in the Ingoldby Trust report, a recession is clearly going to happen very soon.
Yeah, and I'm also thinking they indicated a pause now, but said that they would continue to raise rates later. But if you look historically, they have never paused rate hikes to then continue to raise. So I would say the probability of them doing that now after this hawkish cycle is, I mean, very small.
Well, Anna, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I tweeted that out this morning. For some reason, people still, you know, believe that everything that central bankers are forecasting, I do not see too many big developments that actually central bankers forecasted over the last couple of years. I mean, they didn't see inflation coming up. We put out a special report.
It came from nowhere.
Yeah, we forecasted. We put out a special report in fall 2020, a special report on inflation, said now is the time to cautiously reduce liquidity in the system, to cautiously start raising rates. But nobody listened to us. So in 2021, everybody kept telling us, well, it's only transitory. And still up until basically spring 2022, central bankers kept telling us, well, inflation is not a problem at all. Stagflation will not happen. So I don't see why people still believe everything that central bankers forecast. And I tweeted this out this morning, as I've said. Kevin Muir, who is one of my favorite writers out there, he put out a great piece today. It was called The Violence Within the Stock Market. And he just showed the dot plots. For example, in 2021, the dot plots, they indicated that the FOMC members thought that Fed funds would be between 0.75% and 1%. event in 2023. And right before the hiking cycle at the end of 2021, they still forecasted that interest rates would basically be slightly above 1% at the end of 2023. So, you know, I don't want to criticize central bankers all the time, but just say, well, actually, they didn't get it really right the last time. So why should they get it right this time?
But it's fine. You're among friends here. We definitely feel the same way. I talk about it as the privileged misconception, because in Europe and especially in Sweden, the only thing anyone knows about inflation up until a couple of years ago is that that was something the central bankers said we had too little of. So that is like the only knowledge people have. So that's where they're coming from. And I want to touch more about like the confidence level in the Fed chair, because I know that you talked about that in the report as well. But I would just like to quote something from this year's report, and that is, the gold price does not rise, but fiat currencies depreciate over the term relative to gold, some more, some less. And could you just elaborate on the meaning behind this statement?
Well, you know, I think it's a matter of perspective, and if you change perspective, I think that you know, changes your thinking. So I always thought right at the beginning that it's actually the price of gold that is rising, but then I realized at some point that actually it is the purchasing power of fiat money that is falling, and this falling purchasing power can be measured, for example, you know, in terms of real estate, in terms of commodities, but also in terms of equities. So from my point of view, and I think this is really important to emphasize, I think gold's role is not to make you rich. Gold's role is you know, to basically protect your purchasing power. And I think over the very long history, gold did its job pretty well. And therefore, you know, if you know our report, we always try. We don't always get it right, but we try to understand the big picture. And if you have a look at those long-term comparisons of gold measured in other currencies, or the purchasing power of gold measured in other currencies, then you get a totally different view. Now, Anna, I always say that I did keynotes, I think, in 35 countries all over the globe. And the best questions are always asked in high inflation countries. For example, I did two big keynotes in Istanbul a couple of years ago. And those people sitting in the audience, they knew everything about gold. They asked me really, really tough questions. Why? Because they're used to a rubbish currency. They're used to high inflation. So for them, actually, gold is not, you know, some sort of a satellite investment. It's a core. And I think we're slowly going back to that environment where, you know, we all are basically conditioned by this great moderation. 40 years of falling inflation rates, 40 years of very low inflation volatility, of macro stability. And I think that, you know, there's very, very few practitioners in the market that actually managed money over the high inflation period of the 1970s. There's very, very few around. So I think that we all suffer from this recency bias. And therefore, I think that, you know, gold as a protector of purchasing power is slowly but surely really, really coming back. And I think that's a big difference for Austria and Germany, for example. If you compare it to Sweden, as far as I know, Sweden didn't really experience a hyperinflation. Is that right?
Yeah.
No. Yeah, that's right. But we do have one of the weakest currencies in the developed world. I mean, I think it's only the yen that's on par with the Swedish krona in terms of weakness. So I mean, gold in terms of the Swedish krona has been a fabulous protection against inflation. So.
But then I still wonder why gold isn't really a big topic in Sweden, and yes. And I would say that you know, if you have a look at consumer demand in Germany and in Austria, for example, it's significantly larger compared to most other developed countries, and my answer or my thesis would be that we are still very, very much influenced by the hyperinflation that our grandparents experienced. Yeah. So first it was in Austria and then Weimar Republic in Germany. And I think it is, it might sound a bit esoteric, but I think it's within our monetary DNA to have gold as some sort of a fiat money hedge. And I think that's actually something that, you know, that we get from our parents, from our grandparents, from stories where they lost everything through currency reforms, through hyperinflation. And I think that's one of the main reasons for that. So therefore, I would say to answer your question regarding the purchasing power of money, I would say that if you have a look at those long-term comparisons, for example, we do gold measured in beer at the Munich Oktoberfest. We do the same with gold measured in iPhones, for example, gold measured in oil terms, measured in real estate. The conclusion is gold over the long term really protects your purchasing power. That's really the main job that gold has.
But there's also another misconception about gold, and that is that you can only measure it in US dollars, which I don't really understand. And that is also a conversation we had, or a discussion we had in Sweden with other investors a few months ago, where I said you cannot compare the Swedish stock market in the Swedish krona to the gold price in USD. You need to look at the gold price in SEK. But most people felt that I was wrong. And for me, because they argued then that you can, the gold price in SEK is just like a result of the Swedish krona being weak to the US dollar. Where do you think this misconception comes from? Because I also noticed that you wrote about that in the report, that the gold price in US dollar receives much more media attention, even in the Eurozone.
Yes, I think you know, if you're basically earning your money in Swedish krona terms, and if you're investing your money in Swedish krona terms, I think it is highly relevant what the Swedish krona does. The same with gold in euro terms. So therefore, I think it's important to measure gold not only in US dollar terms, which is still for the time being the world reserve currency, and everything is traded in dollar terms, but also in your local currency. So if you say that's nonsense, then well actually talk to savers, to investors in Turkey or in Argentina or wherever. For them it's highly relevant, actually. And if you have a look at, for example, the Venezuela stock market, it looks like a fantastic development, yeah. But if you measure it in hard money terms, yeah, actually you see that it's just a disaster. So I think it definitely makes sense to follow the gold price in your local currency terms. It definitely does, and very few people do that. And as we write in the report, actually, you know, everybody's just staring at the dollar price of gold. Because, yeah, as I've said, it's traded in dollar terms. However, in basically every other currency, not only emerging market currencies, but also developed market currencies, gold is doing tremendously well. And I mean, year to date, for example, in dollar terms, gold is up, I think, 7.7%. In euro terms, it's up 6%. In Japanese yen terms, it's up 17%. Sorry about that. I should have prepared better. I don't know what the performance is like in Swedish krona terms, yeah. But I think it's probably a positive performance. And I think this divergence between gold actually doing really, really well, but of course everybody's just staring or just being disappointed with gold not making new all-time highs in dollar terms yet. But then on the other hand, gold doing making new all-time highs in basically every other currency. I think this is telling me that you know, once we hit new all-time highs in dollar terms, and this will go hand in hand with the showdown in monetary policy, then I think that FOMO will kick in. Then I think that many institutional players will actually start reconsidering mining gold. I know from talking to many institutional players, you know, they want to buy gold, but they're still slightly disappointed. And I know that they are very, very pro-cyclical in their behavior. So I would say once we hit new all-time highs, we can go quickly to 2300, 2500. And, you know, I tweeted that out last night, you know, 10 years at 3.8% and gold at 1960. That's, I wouldn't have expected that. So I think that if the disinflationary short-term trend will continue, then of course this will release pressure from central bankers. They will say, well, we did it. We killed inflation. Of course, for the recession, everybody else will be blamed. But not them. But I think this will be the point in time when they say, well, actually, we can start lowering rates again. And this will be the point in time when gold really, really takes off.
Yes, but then you have the problem. I mean, now that the strong dollar has kept the lid on inflation in the US. But if that reverses and we get a weaker dollar and the gold price goes up against the dollar significantly, then I mean inflation will come back to US like a tidal wave, and then they're back in this sort of dilemma showdown, how to fight inflation and still keep the financial system intact. And that's what I mean by that. They have to make some sort of choice in the end, either choose between hyperinflation or a total reset of the whole system.
Well, hyperinflation, it's probably further down the road and I wouldn't focus. Yeah, you know, if we have a look at the 1970s, you know, who would have expected that gold rises from $30 up to $850, and that we will see two major inflation waves? And this is also some sort of our game plan for the next couple of quarters. So disinflation for now, and then the next inflation wave up, starting probably somewhere next year. But who would have thought that actually, you know, gold would do so well in the 1970s in this stagflationary environment, where at the end everybody expected you know, hyperinflation and the end of the US dollar, and let's not forget, you know, that the Americans had to issue US debt, I think in Deutschmark and also in Swiss francs, because nobody wanted to buy US dollar denominated debt anymore. So I think, you know, we will be in for a next inflationary wave, definitely, but it's probably too early to you know, to call the end of the US dollar. And you know, we're writing about this de-dollarization for I think 7 years now, and I think if we compare the US dollar to the euro, if you would ask me what do you rather want to hold, I would definitely go for the US dollar.
But yeah, but this assumes that the US is in the same fiscal position as the 70s, which they're obviously not. So
yes.
I mean today they can't do what Volcker did for obvious reasons with the debt and the budget deficits. So but I think this is what has kept the lid on gold price in terms of dollars, since people assume that the Fed can do the same thing as they did in the 70s, but we both know that that's impossible. So that's what I think. I mean, this is going to look like 70s on steroids, because they can't do anything about it, really.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point, and we did a presentation on that where we actually said that, you know, if you say that Jay Powell is the new Paul Volcker, it's like saying that Danny DeVito is the new Brad Pitt.
That's a good analogy.
Sense, yeah. Because first of all, you rightly said that that situation is completely different, Powell versus Paul Volcker back then. But I think what's also very, very important is that I think Paul Volcker was, first of all, he had the full support from the White House. And I think if we move into a recession, there will be huge criticism on the Federal Reserve. I as I've said, we've got an election coming up, and I don't think that the Federal Reserve will have full support of Joe Biden. They will criticize him big time. And the second thing is, we saw major investments in the oil space due to that spike in oil prices, and the result was major discoveries that really helped this disinflationary trend and that lowered oil prices significantly. So the debt situation, but also the political situation, and then the oil price were major differences. And I think if we compare the current setup to the past, I think it's really interesting that, you know, it's not only the US, it's basically all other major developed economies. Yeah, we are facing some sort of a trilemma of macro imbalances. So first of all, we are seeing the inflationary concerns or the stagflationary concerns like in the 1970s. But then we are seeing some sort of a speculative environment like in the late 1920s and the late 1990s. And then we are seeing a debt problem, a debt issue that is reminiscent of the 1940s when we came out of the Second World War. So this makes it only more complicated. And I mean, you measured hyperinflation previously, and you know, some sort of a debt relief. I don't know. I'm not 100% sure if this will be the way out. Yeah, I think at some point, if you study monetary history, I think there will be, let's call it, a reorganization of our monetary system. I think that's probably the way that we are, the direction that we are moving into. And I think that, you know, now we can discuss gold at 1900 or 2300, whatever. But I think over the course of such a transition period, I think this will be the period, the phase when you really want and have to own gold, because then we are talking about significantly higher numbers. And just one last thought regarding this reorganization of our monetary system. Well, actually, you know, the big guys. So if we do this poker analogy, you want to play high stakes poker with the big boys, then you have to bring chips to the table. And usually those chips are golden. So the US still owns more than 8,000 tons of gold. Within the Eurozone, we've got more than 10,000 tons of gold. We know that China and Russia own significant amounts of gold. We know that the IMF owns more than 3,000 tons of gold. Turkey is buying like crazy. Most of the oil exporters are buying physical gold. So I think that even though central bankers, they still pretend that they couldn't care less about gold, I think they clearly know why they own gold in their vaults as some sort of a central reserve currency. And within the Western world, you know, I think it's 18.9% on average is the gold allocation of central banks. That's pretty significant, I would say.
Yeah, I heard a good quote there, that the arsonists are the first that to smell the smoke, and I think they know that they've lit this inflation fire, and they can smell the smoke early. But then, as you said, it can also be a hedge against the political uncertainty or sort of conflicts going forward.
But to go back to the reserve currency system that we have today, I'm thinking, do we really need to have one reserve currency in the future? Doesn't it look, if you look at global currency reserves, that they are being more and more diversified than they have before? I mean, look at the share of US dollar, how that has evolved since year 2000. I think you also brought that up in the report, and that's something also that I've been following for a few years. And you see China settling a lot of their trades in the yuan, for example, giving out the yuan credits to both the countries in Africa and South America. So do you really think that I don't think we're going to go to a place where we actually shift the reserve currency, but more so that we're going to see a future where we're just settling trades trade in the currency of like the biggest currency that you're trading with, instead of China trading with Argentina and settling that transaction in US dollar. It doesn't make any sense today, I think.
Yes, I mean, that's really one of the topics that have gone mainstream recently. So back until, let's say, 2022, this whole de-dollarization was, you know, that's wasn't a big topic. But I think over the last couple of months, we saw that it is really going mainstream. We've seen the DFT, Bloomberg, whatever, even Fox News. Yeah, they were making the case for this geopolitical showdown and this de-dollarization that we are now experiencing. So I think it's a kind of a showdown between, you know, the saturated established nations here in the Western world, and then the hungry upstarts and from the emerging markets. And I think, you know, if you have a look, for example, at the share of global GDP, BRICS versus G7 nations, measured in purchasing power parity. Well, actually, the importance of BRICS, or the size of BRICS on global GDP, is now larger than G7 nations. So it's no wonder that, well, actually, they become more self-confident. And we have seen those developments in history quite often, you know, with the Greeks versus Sparta, for example, yeah, where they completely underestimated the rise of Athens, and you know, Sparta was pretty sure that they're gonna win and that they will stay the global hegemon. So I think, you know, what's going on in this sphere of the geopolitical developments is extremely interesting, and I think it's no coincidence that last year we saw a new all-time high when it comes to central bank buying. And it is mostly emerging market nations that are increasing their gold positions. And I think it's some sort of a sign of confidence, and it's I think the symbolical character of China, but also Russia, now again officially announcing their gold purchases again. That's clearly a sign that, well actually, there's the world is breaking into kind of two blocks. And I think that, you know, 2022 with the war and the sanctions against Russia, where the Western world basically said with the stroke of a pen, well, your currency reserves are worthless. Yeah, I think that was a look into the playbook for many other emerging market nations, that now, you know, they have become a little bit more cautious. And I think, you know, if you want to diversify out of the US dollar, I think you want to own a currency that is extremely liquid, and gold is traded. You know, there was a study by the LBMA that the trading volume is 140 billion per day. So it's a highly liquid market. It is a highly sophisticated market. It's a global market. It is a currency or an asset without any counterparty risk, which is also very important. Yeah, it's just pure possession. There's no, you know, conditions involved when you own physical gold. And gold is kind of neutral. So I think that through this political development that we're seeing, gold is kind of coming back. It's seeing a renaissance in this big political game. And I think when it comes to the question reserve currency versus trade currency, I think people often mix it up. I think that the US dollar is clearly losing share as a trade currency, where we're seeing basically on a daily basis new agreements between, you know, energy exporters, commodity exporters, and other nations that settle their trades
not in US dollar terms, but rather in local currency terms. But when it comes to reserve currency question, I think there's the dollar still clearly is the number one. And I would say that the number two, which is actually the euro, which is the second largest reserve currency, is probably more threatened for the time being than the US dollar.
So we are running out of time. So, and I know that Martin really wanted to discuss your perspective on Bitcoin. So in the report, so let's make this the final question, I think. So in the report you mentioned, with the invention of Bitcoin, we're witnessing a live experiment in monetary invention. Could you just tell us a little bit more about what you mean with that?
Well, actually, we manage two funds that combine gold with Bitcoin and some other cryptocurrencies. For example, one of them is 75% physical gold, 25% Bitcoin, with a rebalancing strategy and an options overlay, where we say, well, actually, you can make use of the volatility of Bitcoin. And by the way, the volatility of Bitcoin has been very, very, very low recently, and I think that Bitcoin is poised for a breakout of volatility going forward.
I agree with that, definitely.
So I think that we got interested in Bitcoin very, very early on, I think in 2012, and then over the years we talked to financial market authorities, we talked to the regulators, and then did set up one of the very first regulated funds in the Western world, and I think it's Bitcoin. I think Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever it was, he clearly understood gold. He clearly understood sound money. He clearly understood the Austrian School of Economics. And I think, when it comes to gold, the stock to flow ratio is key. And I think, due to the halving, every 4 years, the stock to flow ratio of Bitcoin rises. And, with the next halving next year in spring, Bitcoin will even be significantly harder money than gold. So therefore, I would say, why not own both? Of course, gold has a track record that is significantly higher, a couple of thousand years, actually, where gold did its job tremendously well, while on the other hand, Bitcoin, is hardly a teenager now. But I think, if you have a look, for example, at the dominance of Bitcoin, you can see that Bitcoin is clearly the number one. We see lots of innovation in the space, and therefore I think combining both definitely makes sense, although we get a lot of criticism both from the gold camp but also from the Bitcoin camp, but that's fair enough, and I have to tell you, I truly enjoy those discussions, and I think it's very, very important, because in the gold camp, I would say the demographics are a little bit older, and people are not so much open to new technologies, while in the Bitcoin camp, it's very, very, a very, very young crowd, and those people, they start reading, they start educating themselves about sound money, about the Austrian school. They ask the question, what is good money? What are the requirements for sound money? And I think this is a very, very important discussion, and therefore I kind of enjoy being in both camps, and I think it's a prudent strategy to combine both. So therefore, I would say that if Bitcoin will stay around, and if our big picture macro development plays out, I see a bear market in fiat money and a bull market in sound money. And I think that if you have a look at stock to flow, as I've said, you want to own currencies with a very, very high stock to flow ratio, and therefore gold and Bitcoin are the two go-to places for us.
Yeah, I mean, my problem with Bitcoin, I mean, they have really done a good job of trying to emulate gold, and you often hear this term as digital gold. But for me, they've sort of missed sort of the key point of gold, which is the store of value. And since Bitcoin doesn't have any value to store, I mean, gold you store the future sort of use of it. We don't know what we can use gold for in the future, but you can use it for something. But you can't use Bitcoin for anything in the future except to give it somebody else. And so you miss that sort of crucial part for something to become money. But I'm not saying Bitcoin can't go up from here, and I sympathize a lot with the Bitcoin community and the libertarian sort of side and the fiat sort of currency collapse side of it. So
yeah, if I just may add one point, Martin, I think yes, you are right, and I think that when it comes to the I think that, as I've said, Bitcoin is only growing up, and I see that if I compare the level of sophistication when it comes to trading infrastructure, when it comes to institutionalizing the setup, I think that there's huge developments happening. And then I think the trading pattern of Bitcoin changes, because it used to be a risk-on asset. The correlation with the Nasdaq, for example, was extremely high. But then what happened in spring was when we saw those regional US banks failing. I thought it was pretty interesting that that Bitcoin was up, I think, on one of those days, like 10%. So it might kind of change from being a risk-on asset to becoming a risk-off asset. Yeah. So what I want to say is, those developments are dynamic. We're seeing that now with the discussion regarding the ETFs. I think that there will be significantly larger institutional demand coming in. But I don't know if, as I've said, if Bitcoin will be around in 10 years. I simply don't know. But I know if it will be still around, then I would say that the price should be significantly higher. Will gold be around in 10 years, and will it protect your purchasing power measured in real estate in Stockholm, measured in beer at the Munich Oktoberfest, or measured in iPhones? I think yes, it will continue to do its job due to the Lindy effect and so on. But I think it's prudent to own both, obviously volatility adjusted.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I really hope we get the opportunity to talk more to you in a future podcast episode as well. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's really been an honor. And again, you don't just talk the talk. I mean, with writing this report, you also walk the walk. Yes. with your Incrementum funds, which have done phenomenally well. So I recommend everybody to check them out at incrementum.com.
Thank you very much for having me, Anna and Martin. I don't know when this podcast will be published. But tomorrow
on Thursday,
Austria will be playing again
against Sweden.
I have to say, I hope that we'll win. But
I don't think we have. Now I'm gonna add. I know absolutely nothing about football, so but I don't think we have a very good team. That's what I've heard. But I'm
you
also
don't
leaving
have
with
Zlatan anymore.
I don't know.
No,
if
and
know
but
we
I'm
play
but
anymore.
I'm leaving with an Argentinian, so he only compares everyone with Messi. So
okay.
So it was amazing to get the opportunity to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks
for joining us.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Remember that nothing we said in this podcast is supposed to be investment advice.
All investments are risky, and you could lose all or parts of your invested capital.
Remember to do your own analysis, and don't trust anything you hear on the streets.
Thank you for listening.